Hey, like Ryan said, my name's Dean, and I am thrilled to be here with you. I come and see some of you that I've known for a long time, and I'm really bitter. I'm just going to be honest, I'm really bitter. So we'll let Ed recruit over there, and I'll recruit over here maybe. How's that? We'll do that. For some of you I haven't met yet, maybe this is the first time. Thrilled that you're here. Glad for God's activity, what God's doing here. God's bringing people to himself here in Westerville. Happy Father's Day to all the dads. Who are out there. I know that today you want to clap for dads. You can clap for dads. Clap for dads. And at the same time, I know it's a great day. I know that it's also a difficult day for a lot of people. Maybe you lost a father this year. Maybe your relationship with your father is not good, or maybe what God intended for it to be. So we know that somewhere in the tension, in the middle of that, we hope that you're finding space to worship your Heavenly Father and to connect well with him. We've been in this series, you know, for a couple of months called I Am, and we're looking at that revealed name of God in the Old Testament. God revealed to Moses his name, I Am, and what kind of happens is that Jesus kind of comes along in the New Testament, and he kind of adds the predicate to the beginning of the sentence, if I can say it that way. Jesus makes these statements. He says, I am the gate, I am the way, I am the bread of life, I am the water of life. I'm over and over again, and so with each of these statements that we're looking at in the Gospel of John, what happens is we see God defining himself to us more and more. And as God defines himself, he also defines us. So the way that we've said that is that I am really reveals or determines who I am. Or maybe you guys have said that I am determines who we are. And you kind of said it in a collective sense. But as God reveals to us his identity in the person of Christ, what happens is our identity becomes clearer and we learn then how God wants us to live. I don't know how you got here, not just got here today, but even got here, got connected to LifePoint. A few years ago, my wife Angie and I, and Angie, I wish she could be here with me this morning. She's got other things going on. She's going to stop at Lewis Center this morning, and we've got something going on with our daughter. But we were having lunch with a couple, and they had been at LifePoint for a couple of years at that point. And so first time we'd had the opportunity to sit down and talk with them. And the wife, she was real expressive. She was excited. And she said, listen, we love everything, like coming to the church, and we love the messages and music. And she said, for us, she said, it was LifePoint Kids. It's like, it was LifePoint Kids. She said, for us, that was the first hooker for us. Now, she meant to say hook, but she said hooker. And so we've decided we're going to rebrand the children's ministry. We're going to call it LifePoint Kids, Your Child's First Hooker. We think it will be wildly successful. We think it's going to go over like gangbusters. So I don't know what the hooker was for you to get here, to be here. But I do know this, that for a lot of us, whenever we come to church or whenever we come to relationship with God, a lot of us come because of difficult circumstances that are going on in our lives. And that's great. And it's also dangerous in some ways, because a lot of us, especially in American Christianity, we come to God in the hope that God will solve all of our problems. And so if you're not careful, what can happen is that you can very easily kind of become a conditional disciple, if I can call it that. In other words, you're going to follow as long as the conditions are right. As long as God is solving your problems, as long as God is providing you a certain level of comfort or ease or feeling that you're looking for, then you're good to follow. But when the circumstances become adverse in your life, then you kind of step back from that. It's kind of a conditional mentality. Well, one thing that we learn over time is that, man, that's going to fail. I've learned just from being a husband, there's something inside of men, especially, we tend to want the product without walking through the process, right? And so when it comes to God, the product of becoming a disciple and becoming a mature follower of his, there's a process that comes along with that, just like there's a process in marriage. One of the things maybe that you've learned as a husband is that there are differences in the way that you and your wife think. That's not just cultural. Like, men's and women's brains are different, like genetically, scientifically, right? Anatomically, they're wired differently. Women's brains are like iPhones, right? They think about multiple things at a time. I have learned that my wife can simultaneously think about what's for dinner, a friend who's in relational trouble, a sale at Kohl's, and how to reorganize the basement. All at the same time, she's thinking all those things. So women's brands are like iPhones. Men's brands are like flip phones, right? You get one thing, or maybe I should say bag phones. Go back a little further for some of you. One thing at a time. If for men, it's real simple. F-O-O-D. It's just one thing at a time. We get that straight, and it's kind of like we got everything else moving and straight and going in the right direction. So what you find is that as a spouse, you are continually in the process of learning and engaging principles that will help your marriage grow over time. It's not that just that you say, I do, and then it's done, and everybody's all happy, and it just works. No, it takes intentional effort to engage the process if you want the product. Now, the reason that's important and pertinent to us today is because a couple of weeks ago, you guys looked at John 10, right? When Jesus said, I'm the good shepherd. Well, in John 10, Jesus says, I have come that you might have life and that you might have an abundant life. Jesus did not say that I have come that you might have belief. But a fundamental struggle in American Christianity is that we say that we are Christians just because we believe certain things. One of the last verses in the Gospel of John, John says, these things I have written to you in believing you might have life. Not that in believing you might have believing. The goal of Christianity is not believing certain things. It's not enough for you and I to say, hey, I've got these doctrines, these things I believe, or not just even enough to say, well, you know what? I believe in God. Believing in God doesn't make you a Christian. It's that in believing, there's this growing life that comes to us. So what you see in the Gospel of John is that as Jesus walks through, or as John writes through, writes to us about the life of Jesus, and as he walks through different pictures, different visuals, different happenings in the life of Jesus, what we find is that there's this growing awareness of the process that leads to the product of becoming a mature Christ follower. And Jesus uses a key word. If you go home and read the Gospel of John, and the truth is, you could sit down and read the Gospel of John in about an hour. I would encourage all of you to do that at some point. Sit down, start front to back. You can read the whole thing in about an hour, and I think one thing that will definitely jump out at you is a little four-letter word that Jesus uses over and over and over in the Gospel of John, and it's the word S-E-N-T, sent. 57 times in the Gospel of John, Jesus uses that particular word. He says, behold, I was sent by my Father. As I was sent, so I am sending you. Over and over and over again. What if you and I had a conversation that lasted for about an hour and 57 times I used the same word? What if you and I had a conversation and I said the word Trump 57 times in 1 hour? What would that be like? It'd be like the evening news, right? That'd be just like watching the evening news because that's about what happens. You would think, well, that's something maybe that's important to him, whether you're on the right side of the aisle or the left side of the aisle. Doesn't matter. 57 times Jesus uses that word sent. It means something. And today what we're going to do is we're going to try and connect up. We're going to move a little bit backwards in the Gospel of John. We're going to look at a passage in chapter 7. We're going to try and connect it to chapter 9. And we're going to look at the reality and the meaning and the why behind that word sent. But before we do, I want you to say that word with me on three. Ready? One, two, three. Sent. All right? Turn to John chapter 7. If you've got a copy of the scriptures. And we'll start in John chapter 7 in verse 2. It says this. Now, the Feast of Booths was at hand. In the Old Testament, God gave the children of Israel seven feasts. These are seven mandated parties, which tells you something about the character of God. God said seven times a year, you're going to get together and you're going to party and celebrate like crazy. This one, the Feast of Booths or the Feast of Tabernacles, had two meanings. One was agricultural. One was spiritual. Agriculturally, the feast fell at that point of the year when the harvest had just come in. So they celebrated the feast as a way to say to God, God, you have provided for all of our needs. You provided the rain that led to the crops that we are taking in. So today, as we get together, the Feast of Booths was a week long, but every day they would say, God, we're celebrating you as you provide for us. The spiritual side of that is that during this week-long feast, and if you can imagine, it's very similar to what we've done in American history at points. People left their houses and they camped all week. That's why it's called the Feast of Booths or the Feast of Tabernacles. For us, in our language, it would be the Feast of Tents. People tent camped all week long. They all left their houses. It was like, well, probably not all like Woodstock, but you get the idea, right? Everybody in tents, out, and they're kind of, and the reason that they did that is because part of the celebration was spiritual. And the spiritual side of this celebration was the reality that they were reminding themselves that for 40 years they wandered around in the wilderness. They wandered in circles in the wilderness because they didn't believe God and they didn't trust him on the Exodus. So for 40 years they were just spinning their wheels like this. And they lived during that time in tabernacles or booths or tents. That's how they lived. So this feast was a reminder. So here's how they did it. Every day for 8 days they had a parade. It's all, man, you can go back and look at it in Leviticus chapter 23. Some of it was, the practical side of it was added in the Midrash a little later, but you can go back, you can read about all the origins of it. What they did every day is they had a parade. You know, Jerusalem doesn't have natural sources of spring-fed water, so they have a system of aqueducts. So every day they would land at a pool. And one day, or the last day of the feast, they land at the Pool of Siloam. I'll show you a picture of it up here so you can see it and kind of see what it looks like. So I have these aqueducts that piped water through the city. So what they would do is, every day, at the same day, one time a day, they would have a parade. And the parade had different groups of people. It had singers and clappers and dancers, and they would move through the city. So I thought we would reenact that, okay? So you guys are going to be the dancers, okay? Now, just so we don't get ourselves in trouble, we're gonna call it wave. We're gonna wave like this for the dancing, okay? So give me ready. Give me you're the wavers. Good. Oh, very good. Very good. Very good. All right, you guys here in the middle, you guys are the singers, okay? So we're just gonna we're just gonna keep it real simple. We're gonna hit a consistent note together, and you're gonna ask me what note. I don't know. Whichever one I hit, you hit. Okay, ready? Here we go. That's lame. Come on. Very good, very good, very good. That makes you guys the clappers, all right? So we're going to do it real simple. We're going to go. Very good, very good, very good, very good. Okay, so every day, they get everybody in the city. They get out together. They get everybody in the line of this big, big parade. And so there are dancers. Give me some dancing. Clappers. Come on, singers, come on, singers, the wavers. And so while all that's going on, the high priest gets a pitcher. He goes to the Pool of Siloam. He gets out in front of the pool, and everybody stops. And he takes a pitcher, this water out of the pool, and he dumps it out on the ground, just like that. And the whole idea when he dumps this pitcher is that God has provided rain and water for our crops this year, so we have food. So everybody goes crazy. Come on. Like, crazy like we just beat Michigan, right? Very good. Very good. All right. So they do that for 7 days, right? And for 7 days, they celebrate like crazy. And then they get to the eighth day, the last day of the feast. They called it the great day of the feast. And on the great day, here's what they would do. They'd get everybody out. They'd get the parade back together. So they'd have dancers. They'd have singers. They'd have clappers. Right? The priest would come up in front of them at the pool, and everybody would stop. And then he would go like this. And there's no water. And everybody was silent on the eighth day. And the reason they were silent is because they were reminding themselves that our forefathers wandered around in circles for 40 years because they didn't trust God to provide for them on their way into the promised land. So that's the background of John chapter 7. And you've got to think that it was in that moment, John chapter 7, verse 37 occurs. On the last day of the feast, the great day, Jesus stood up and cried out, If anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as the scripture has said, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water. Then in the middle of the silence, in the middle of the reminder that, you know what, our forefathers didn't trust God in the way that they should have, Jesus said, listen, if you're thirsty, come to me. Because what happens, see, in the Old Testament is that water becomes a picture of spiritual life. There is a river, the psalmist said, there is a river whose streams make glad the city of God. The psalmist said, as the deer pants for water, so my soul longs for you. And what Jesus is saying to the people is, don't you see it? No river, no life. No water, no life. No lake, no life. No stream, no life. Jesus said, the reason that you don't have life is because you haven't come to me. Yes, you have belief, but the point of belief is not belief. It's not that in believing you have belief. It's that in believing you might have life. Jesus said, if anybody wants life, let them come to me. So it brings us to a principle. Here's the principle. The principle is that providence takes precedence. Providence takes precedence. In other words, if you call yourself a Christian, the providence of God in your life becomes paramount. It becomes first. Providence, a weird word. It's a Latin word. Actually, it's two Latin words smushed together. The word pro is the first word. It's a prefix that means before. Second word is the word videre. It's where it means to see. It's where we get our word for video, right? So to provide means to see before. So when we say that God is our provider, Abraham called God Jehovah Jireh, our provider. To say that God is your provider, my provider, means that he sees our needs beforehand, and that he has already met all of our needs. Not all of our wants, all of our needs. There's a big difference. I'll give you an example. This is a participation exercise, okay? Only do this in light of your physical health. Everybody take the big deep breath. Hold it. You know what? We don't think about breathing very much. About 500 times since you've been here, you've breathed. About 23,000 times a day, 8.4 million times a year, about 670 million times during your lifetime will you draw breath. And you don't think about it until you can't do it. You don't think about it until somebody holds your head underwater too long. You don't think about it until, for some reason, the breath gets knocked out of you and you, for a few seconds, cannot breathe. You can breathe, by the way, now. I'm not going to come on. You don't think about it until you can't do it. God will 670 million times on average in your lifetime provide breath for you, and it won't even be a second thought. That's why the psalmist says every breath that comes out of us is what? It's praise. Every breath that comes, because God provides for us not only the air that we breathe, but the capacity and the ability to. So if you're a Christian, what you say is, you know what, that's right. And the breath that I breathe, the air that I have, the air that I draw, every breath, what comes out of me, all should be to the praise and the glory of God, my creator. See, God's providence is what kills entitlement. There's something inside of you and there's something inside of me that thinks, you know what? I deserve it. I earn the goodness that I have. I earn the work of my hands. That's another good illustration. It's not just the breath that you breathe. Think about things physically. Think about your resources. I need some help. Charlie, will you come here for a second? Come here, buddy. So let's say I see Charlie. I haven't seen Charlie in a long time. He's grown up on me. So Charlie, let's say I've got $10, right? And I say to you, I'm glad you're here. I'm glad you're at church today. And I'm going to give you $10. Good deal? Good deal. All right. Good. And let's say Charlie's walking back to his seat. And while Charlie's walking back to his seat, I think, oh, I've got to get a bottle of water on the way home. So Charlie, before you go, could I have one of those dollars back? You'd say that, right? Still a pretty good deal, right? Yeah. So you go on back to your seat. Charlie, what if I said you show up here every week? Every week you show up. I'll give you $10. You give me $1 back, just as a way to say thank you and that you show dependence on me. How would you say? What would you? I can tell you what your dad would say. He would say, good deal. I know. Right? Right? Good. All right. Go ahead. Have a seat. See, it makes, and you, listen, and if you feel good about taking money from your pastor, Charlie, you keep that, okay, buddy? You just keep it. Hey, doesn't it make sense that everything that you and I have, our resources, where do they come from? Well, Dean, I'm the one who goes to work 40 hours a week, but who gave you the ability to go to work 40 hours a week? Who gave you arms and legs and a brain to think? Who gave you the opportunities that you have? You know, we say sometimes, oh, this weird opportunity came. I got promoted. I got da-da-da-da-da-da. Who does that? The God who sees before, provides all of your needs. And God says, hey, you know what? Just as a way to say not only thank you, but to fuel my work in the world and to show the reality that you're dependent on me, all I ask you to do, all I ask you to do is give me back 10%. Good deal? It's a great deal. I would say, financially, for us, that'd be genius. That's a genius move on our part to live with a sense of gratitude. And here's the thing. If we don't do it, that entitlement bug's going to bite you. And you're going to think, oh, never. The more monster is going to wear you out because you're never going to have enough, right? How much do you need? Just a little more. One more promotion. Well, 6 months from now, whenever things start to slow down, right? It'll be. There's something inside of you and there's something inside of me that thinks we can get the product without going through the process. I had the privilege this past week of going to a place called Gull Lake, Michigan, and there was a guy who taught up there for a week. His name's Ron Capico. He is the chaplain at Spring Arbor University. He's been mentoring students. He's been the chaplain up there for about 32 years. He mentors 60 college students a week. He's 72 years old. Can you imagine doing that? He spends a 30 minutes to an hour with 60 college students every week during the school year. He told this story. He said that a few years ago, it's probably been five or six years ago now at Spring Arbor, maybe it's been a little longer than that. He said he went to a basketball game on campus. And he never played basketball. Basketball is not his thing. He played football. On his way in, he's going in, and one of the students stopped him. They said, Chaplain Ron, the halftime shot, you need to put your name in. He's like, no thanks. And as he walked on by, the student said, well, I'll put your name in for you. So you know what happens, right? Halftime, the announcer gets on. He pulls the name out of the hat. He's like, well, our shooter tonight is none other than Ron Capico, our chaplain. Everybody cheers. And he goes out. And it's not that he had to make a three-pointer or a half-court shot. He has to make a three-quarter court shot to win a Chrysler LeBaron. So he walks out there, they throw in the basketball, and he didn't even sign up to do it, right? So he takes it, one dribble, throws it as hard as he can. Ball never gets higher, he said, than the backboard. Nothing but the bottom of the net, right? Crowd goes crazy, wins a Chrysler LeBaron, and he can't believe it. Nobody else can believe it. So next day he's on campus, he walks by, the basketball team is practicing, and they all yell for him to come in. They're all giving him this, right? They're all bowing to him. So they throw him the ball. They're like, do it again. He's like, I couldn't do it last night. How am I going to do it again, right? So they throw him the ball. He throws it, three-quarter court, same thing. This time he banks it in. He's 2 for 2 on three-quarter court shots. 2 weeks later, he's got to go on a mission trip to Guatemala. So he's down there with Spring Arbor students. They happen to be by a basketball court. The Spring Arbor students are telling the people in Guatemala, they're like, it was amazing. They're telling about the whole happening. They get a basketball. They throw it to him. They're like, try it again. And this time he's like, there's no way. I mean, the odds of doing it once are crazy. The odds of doing it twice, no way. So he decides, I'm going to add a little spice to it. I'm going to throw up a hook shot. Three-quarter court, throws up a hook shot, bottoms. He's 3 for 3 on three-quarter court shots in 2 weeks. People are going nuts. And then he stops in that story. You know what he says? He says, some people think becoming a disciple of Christ is like hitting the three-quarter court shot. And he looked at all of us and he said, but it doesn't work that way. There's a process in becoming a faithful follower of Christ that yields a product over a period of time. This conditional discipleship that you and I get into will not cut it. This conditional following where we say, God, I'll follow as long as you give me. I'll follow as long as you do for me. And Jesus sets it up fantastic in the Gospel of John, because what happens is, after he goes to the Feast of Booths and Tabernacles, you get to John chapter 8, where Jesus says, before Abraham was Yahweh, before Abraham was I am. And they want to kill him for that. And so right after that, still in the same time period, we get to John chapter 9. So flip over there. We'll start reading in verse 1. And as he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And the disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Jesus answered, it was not this man who sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of God, the works of the one who sent me, there's that word, while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. Having said these things, he spit on the ground and made mud with the saliva. Then he anointed the man's eyes with the mud, and he said, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which means sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. So Jesus, still in the city of Jerusalem, he walks by the pool of Siloam. There's a man there. He's blind. The disciples ask a really hard question. In fact, Jesus, why was he born blind? Was it his sin? How could it be his sin if he was born blind? Disciples, they kind of missed the dots on that one. Or was it his parents' sin that he was born blind? Is that why he was born blind? And Jesus gives an answer that none of us like, because we all want to blame somebody for bad stuff. Jesus says, it wasn't his sin, nor was it his parents' sin, but we've got the opportunity to work the works of God, so let's do it. Jesus spits in the, spits. I don't know if you ever thought about this. That's a lot of spit, right? Jesus spits in the dirt, right? He makes like some mud, it would have been some sandy grit that he puts on the guy's eyes. He sends him back to the same pool, the pool of Siloam, where they had been just a couple of days before for the Feast of Booths, the water ceremony, the whole thing. The guy goes and he washes his eyes, and miracle upon miracles, he has sight returned or given to him. He comes back and his blindness is cured. Now, let me ask you a couple questions about that. Number one, could Jesus have just healed everybody? Yeah. Did he? No. Could Jesus have said to this guy who was blind, you know what? Be healed. Would he have been healed? Why does he take this particular guy, spit in the dirt, put mud on the guy's eyes, and send him to wash in the pool of Siloam? There's a message in that. And here's the thing for you and me. When we tend to read the text, especially in the Gospels, our hearts are drawn to the miracle. But Jesus, I think, would say to us, we need to get the message before we get the miracle. And I understand that we want the miracle. I sat with a couple 3 or 4 weeks ago, a family that comes to our church, and you know what? They had just gotten the miracle. It was incredible. Doctors can't explain it. They don't know why. Family can't explain it. They don't know why. Physical healing, bam, like that. It happened. Illness is gone, done, miracle. And that's what we all want, right? We're all looking for the miracle. But Jesus says there's a message. See, not everybody gets the miracle. I remember, 7 or 8 years ago, Pastor Mark and I went down to Children's Hospital, and we sat with the Mason family. And the Masons were there, and their little son, Zach, had cancer. And because of his cancer and his treatment, he had contracted an infection. He was in hospice, and it was a matter of time before little 8-year-old Zach was going to pass away. And I remember walking out of there that day, and I thought simultaneously two things. I was so mad at sin, mad at the deterioration that takes effect in our bodies. But at the same time, I admired her faithfulness. And if I'm honest, I walked out of there that day thinking, I would like to have her faithfulness. Whatever she has, now I don't want to pay the price. I don't want to pay that price. I don't want to pay that cost. Her faithfulness was the miracle. That someone could walk through what she was walking through as a mom and display the kind of faithfulness that said, I'm going to follow no matter what my circumstances say. See, that kills conditional discipleship. That kills a sense of spiritual entitlement. That was the miracle. So what's the message? Jesus says to the man, I want you to go and I want you to wash your eyes in the pool of Siloam. And then there's just that little parenthetical phrase, which means sent. That's what Siloam means, sent. 57 times I told you in the Gospel of John, that little word is used. What Jesus, I believe, is saying to you and me in that moment is that we have to live. We are blinded to it spiritually. Our eyes have to be opened to the fact that we have to live our lives with a sent mentality. I would say this, we don't just have to live that way, we have to love it. We need a sentimentality about living with a sent mentality. I'll say it to you that way. We need a sentimentality about living with a sent mentality, that understanding that Jesus said, just as the Father sent me, so send I you. As the Father sent me, I'm sending you. How did the Father send him? What did Jesus say? I didn't come to be served, but I came to serve. And to give my life as a ransom for many. So you and I have to understand, and this is really hard in American Christianity, that salvation is not just for us, but salvation is from us. That we are a conduit, not a lake. And the blessings that God gives to us, he gives them to us on purpose. The reason God allows you to draw breath, that's not an accident. The reason God gives you resources, that's not an accident. The reason that he does that is that you get to bless other people, and you get to be part of this incredible plan that God has to reach the world. That's why we say at LifePoint that God has called us to reach Mid-Ohio, the Midwest, and the world. That's why we reach out to other people. That's why we try to make a difference in their lives. That's why we try to give. That's why we try to serve. We give our time, we give our resources, whatever it is that we can do to make a difference in the lives of other people, because people are what lasts forever. Your forerunner is not going to last forever. Your 401k is going to be gone someday. But you're always going to last forever. People. So invest in reaching and ministering to people. You have great opportunities to do that. It's not easy. I think about Sandy Seal. If you ever come to Lewis Center campus, almost every week you're going to find Sandy Seal standing at the middle door, handing out listening guides. Faithful, faithful, faithful. Sandy prayed for her brother Bill to come to know Christ for 42 years. I lose prayers in 42 seconds. That's hard for me to pray that long, right? For 42 years she prayed for her. But do you know the day that Bill confessed? It was a great day. A great day. And the prayers that built up and built up and built up year after year after year are part of the process. This morning, as long as it works out, time works out, I'm going to get out of here as quick as I can. I'm going to go back over to the Lewis Center campus, and I'm going to baptize a guy named Mike Thomas. For 37 years, Mike lived in another kind of belief system. He lived in a belief system that said to go to heaven when you die, you have to be really, or a really, really good person. That if you are a good person, whenever you die, you get to go to heaven, and you don't go to heaven with God. You get your own planet, and on your planet, you get all of the women, all of the virgins that you want. Congratulations, ladies. That's what your eternity is going to be like, right? You get to go to a planet with a man. That's what you get. And that's their system. They don't believe Jesus is the Son of God. They believe Jesus is a Son of God, just like we're all the men anyway, are sons of God, right? And we can have the same kind of life. So it's a totally different belief. 37 years. Something was not clicking for Mike. Mike's got a friend named Phil. Phil's his insurance agent. So he has a meeting with Phil one day, and he's talking to Phil, and all of a sudden they get off on the spiritual topic. And Mike says, this doesn't make sense to me. This reality doesn't, it's not clicking. Phil says, listen, you should just come to my church with me one Sunday. Just once. Just try it out. I know it's different. I know it's something. And he's like, I don't know. This system that he's been in, he's like, I don't know. So Phil just invites. About 6 weeks ago, he brings Mike with him. First time ever in an evangelical church. He hears the gospel, the reality that Jesus died for his sins, paid his way, that it's not on his merit, but it's upon God's grace is the reason that he can't even come to God because Jesus paid for his sins. And Mike is like, yes, first time ever in an evangelical church. Sign me up, he says. He makes a confession of his faith. Whenever he's done in the service, just like you all do here, he goes back, he prays with a member of our prayer team. They give him one of these, you know, little your next 30 days books, takes it home with him. He's all excited, and at the same time, he's a little bit confused. As God would have it, that afternoon, he had a 2 o'clock appointment with an Aflac insurance agent to get some extra insurance. Unbeknownst to anybody, the Aflac agent also goes to LifePoint Lewis Center. He and Mike, they've never met before, right? They had tried to meet. They had tried to get their calendars together, but it hadn't worked. They had put it off 4 times, but they had scheduled it for that Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock. 2 o'clock, doorbell rings. Mike goes, answers his door. In walks the Aflac agent, a guy named Matt from Lewis Center. They sit down. They make small talk for 3 or 4 minutes. And Mike says, Matt, can I ask you a question? Do you go to church anywhere? And Matt says, yeah, I go to church. Do you go to church anywhere? And he said, I went to this church this morning, and I still don't know exactly what happened to me this morning, but God did something completely different in my life. And then he picks up his little book, and he said, and on the way out, they handed me this book, and it's going to tell me what to do next. And Matt says to him, he says, hey, I think we're at the same church this morning. And I just thought, what a unique confirmation for Mike that God gave him to bring Matt. What's that? Providence. God saw Mike's need coming out of 37 years of a different kind of faith, different kind of belief. And he knew exactly what Mike needed, and he provided it exactly for him in that specific moment. So what's the so what today? Here's the so what. Are you in the process? Are you engaging, actively engaging the process? You're here today, you're a dad. Listen, God has called you to an incredible life of joy and sacrifice for your family. Is it easy? No. Is it worth it? I got up this morning. I got up this morning early and went over to make coffee, and right in front of the coffee maker were 3 cards, one from my wife and one each from my 2 daughters. I wouldn't trade them for anything. Easy? No. Worth it? You bet. Are you in the process? Are you serving? Are you giving of your time actively? Listen, on August 22nd here, we're going to have something called a Life Teams Orientation. It's your opportunity to hear about the opportunities to serve the body here. If you're not serving, listen, serving's how you grow. Now, serving's not the only way that you grow, but it's a big part of how you grow. You can tear off that connection card off the back of your listening guide, just put your name, a way that we can contact you, and just put LTO for Life Teams Orientation. You can come, it takes about 45 minutes or so, you hear about the opportunities, and you can decide whether or not you want to serve. Just drop that card in one of the black boxes as you leave today. We'll make sure that you get signed up for that. Maybe you're here today, and maybe you're not a Christian. Maybe you're like Mike, walking into our church 6 weeks ago. And I don't know if you got a different kind of faith, maybe you don't have any faith. But maybe you would say, what happened in Mike's life makes sense. And today, you want to take that same step that Mike took. And today, you would say, you want to believe, put your faith in, and give your life for the sake of the gospel. You would say, you know what? Jesus' death on the cross is my only way to have, I'll never be good enough, my only way to have access to God. So today I'm going to turn away from sin. I'm going to turn away from me and my selfishness, my greed, and I'm going to put my life in God's hands. If you would like to take that step today, I'd love to help you do that. Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, I know that our lives are not always right. I know that we can't always figure everything out. I also know that you are a good, good Father. So Lord, I pray for anybody who's here today, I pray that you'll give them courage if they don't know you to take that faith step, to trust you, to put their faith in you, to believe you. So Lord, give their lives for the sake of something that's bigger than themselves. As we just continue in that attitude of prayers, nobody's looking around right now. It's a real personal time between people and God. But here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to pray up here. And if you want to take that step of following Christ to become a Christian today, not based on what you believe, but based on putting your faith in Jesus' death for you on the cross and giving control of your life to him, you can pray with me. You can take that step today. You don't have to pray it exactly like I pray it. You don't have to say all the words I pray. It's more the intention of your heart. Right there in your seat, you can just pray something like this. Jesus, thank you for dying for me. And thank you for going to the cross in my place. And Jesus, today I'm saying, I'm asking that you would forgive me of my sins and make my heart clean and new. And Jesus, today I'm saying, I put my life in your hands, that I trust you to do what's best, that my life is given to serving you. Thank you for this salvation gift. Again, we're still going to just maintain that attitude of prayer. Scripture's real clear that when you take that step, you let somebody else know. And I'm just going to ask that you would give me the honor, the privilege of being the first person that you tell. You've taken that step. Just by slipping your hand up right now. Would you do that? Nobody's looking around. Just slip your hand up and say, yeah, you can just put them up and take them right back down. It's great. And Lord, I pray for the dads, certainly the dads and moms in the room today, for some of whom today is a difficult day. But Lord, for all of us, regardless of our circumstances, God, I just call us to the process. Process, God, that fights entitlement because you are our provider. I pray, God, for the steps that we can take today, whether that's a step of serving or that's a step of giving financially or that's a step of engaging you in praise and worship, whatever that step looks like. God, I pray that we'll be in it. We'll be in it for the long haul, not just the short run. I pray, God, that you would kill the spirit of conditional discipleship in our lives. It's in your name we pray.